Welcome to the 7th class session of Fairy and Fantasy, and the last class on Sir Launfal. Today we will look at the aftermath of Launfal's lapse in judgment, and at his strangely irrelevant trial.
Okay, today's our last class on Launfal, and the first thing I want to sort of establish is looking at the trial, or sort of trials, it's kind of a several-stage process of Launfal. What exactly is at stake here? What's this trial about? What's he on trial for, exactly? Or maybe we should back up to his, like, what is the accusation before we look at the trial? But, Beth, go ahead.
Supposedly seducing
him. Okay. She claims that he propositioned her, right? Which, needless to say, she refused. Good. So that's one half of the accusation. What's the other half? Right, the scandalous implication, not implication, bald statement that of exactly how much more attractive his lady is than she. So this is what he's brought to trial for? Both things? How does that work, Robert?
Didn't they bring the trial for treason or something? That's what Parker's counting as.
Yeah, now... treason is certainly at issue here. You may not know this, but when you commit adultery with the queen, treason, high treason against the crown, is what you are charged with. And this is not just like because he's the king and it's his personal prerogative. This is a massive political issue. Why is this a massive political issue? Yeah, Stefan? Yeah, this is a huge national issue if the queen is unchaste or thought to be unchaste. And this is, by the way, one of the implications from the beginning. It's not just that, you know, Launfal has sort of high moral standards and is like, oh, I cannot condone these scandalous carryings on of the queen. But he recognizes this creates political chaos. I mean, this is really bad on several levels, not just a sort of abstract moral level, but... when the queen is known to be unchaste, and of course as unchaste as Guenera is in this poem, that's a huge deal. It's a huge deal. Because, yes, it questions, there can be no undoubted legitimate heir if the queen is known to be unfaithful. Because then, even if you have what would appear to be an orderly succession, there could easily arise people who would say, well, that, you know, the prince is not... the king's son. Now, of course, Arthur and Guinevere never have children, so it turns out not to be an issue. But anyway, that's why adultery with the queen is not only problematic in the moral ways that adultery tends to be problematic in a Christian society, but it's also treason against the crown. And you may remember this is Launfal's first reaction when Guinevere propositions him. The first thing he says is, I would not be a traitor. Now, I think we should hear a kind of a double force there. That is, we may be thinking of his own lady, that he's not going to be unfaithful to his lady. He also is, at least in some sense, married, has certainly made vows to her and would be unfaithful to her, and not just to Arthur, if he were to give in to Guinevere. But, of course, also that's literally true. Like, he's saying, I would not be a traitor against my king by sleeping with you, which apparently doesn't bother many other people, but Launfal draws the line at high treason. And that's one of the first things that Guinevere is reacting to. So, yes, it is normal. It's not an exaggeration that this charge, the idea that he is... proposition Guinevere would be a treasonous offense and be a capital offense. Both would be. So that's normal. The second part of it, the whole beauty comparison thing, is a little bit more idiosyncratic. That's not in the normal legal code. That is, like you said, your girlfriend is more beautiful than the queen, therefore death! Certain death awaits you unless you can justify that boast. That's a little bit more unusual. Will?
I mean,
that might, those might not be formal charges, but that seems to be the bigger deal for Arthur. When he brings it up, he says, "Foul traitor, how dare you say that your love's most loathsome attendant is more attractive than my wife? Oh, and you try to sleep with her."
Right. Yeah, it does seem, both to Arthur and to Guinevere, that's really the big deal. I mean, of course, to Guinevere it would make sense because she knows that, in fact, to be the only wrong that he's done. She knows full well that he didn't proposition her. But yeah, I agree, even to Arthur, you get this bizarre sense, like the attempt to commit actual high treason and sexually, you know, just like seduce his wife is the lesser of the two charges. Why? If that doesn't make legal sense, and I don't think it does make legal sense, what other kind of sense does it make? How does it seem to function within this story? Can we make sense of it in the context? Baskin?
I think it gets back to the whole deal that he made with Tramore in the beginning. Because it's like, you know, he's pretty much on trial now for, in a way, breaking that rule from the beginning. And I think it goes back to the whole, you know, what's been discussed.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. It's one of the major things at stake. I mean, he has broken that vow, right? And he is in the really ironic position of, on the one hand, being called to a... Now, he's in trouble with her for breaking his vow, of course, as he knew he would be, as would make sense for him to be. Now, ironically, he's also being charged for by Arthur's court for breaking that vow. And I say that's ironic because why did he do it? Why did he break his promise not to boast of her? What motivated him? We talked about this last time, sort of why she emphasized that.
Patrick?
Because Guinevere provoked him with saying that he doesn't like women.
Right.
And then we talked about the idea of insecurity and someone's reason to boast being because there's some lack of confidence surrounding the situation.
Right, right. His focus on himself, to build himself up and it, in the eyes of other people, right? That he could not take he couldn't take being looked down upon, he couldn't take being being attacked and criticized. He had to, in the end, support himself, right? That is, justify himself in her eyes by boasting, right? Don't think that I don't have a lady. Don't think that I'm a pedophile just because you don't see me going around with a lady. He cares what she thinks about him. He cares what the court thinks about him. So he's trying to sort of recover himself or build himself up in their eyes. But, of course, ironically, that is what puts him on trial for the court. So this is not a question of his sort of choosing preference at Arthur's court versus the preference of his lady, or at least if he tried that, it failed. Right, because he ends up losing both. Yeah, Marta?
Well, and I think in Launfal's defense, it's not like he hasn't had moments where he's been lowly before. It's, you know, he had years of being poor and a beggar, and he just took it like a man. But there's something about Guinevere that gets under his skin, so I think that's important to remember that it's her. That's her.
Yes, I agree. It is because, I mean, I think that he's been back at court now for a while, and he was gone for a while. Quite a bit of time passes in this poem. That's another way in which it differs from the original. We don't get that same sense of time, like 7 years have gone by and all this. We don't get these clear markers of time or much sense that this has taken such a long time as it does here. So yeah, it's been a while that he's been back, and he's not had a lady the whole time. This would... judging from what we can see of the context of other romances and things at this time, already make him kind of deviant socially. We can see the dancing that they do and the knights and ladies mixing and things. He doesn't have a lady that he champions. We know that that's important even from the challenge of Sir Valentine the Giant, right? You know, if you have a good lady who is excellent, then come to defend her honor and fight me. So we can see that that's important. We see him fend that off there, but yeah. So presumably he would already have been facing a certain amount of alienation, you know, of being and being seen to be deviant from the rest of the court or outside socially in certain ways. But yeah, Guinevere. That's in the end where he draws the line, right? That's the last straw that he can't take. What else? What else do you notice from the trial? Yeah, okay.
When he's accused of sleeping with the queen, the King Arthur sort of confronts all the knights, and they kind of can't deny that she's done this before.
Yeah, this is another interesting thing. Not only is the accusation of adultery with the queen or attempted adultery with the queen seem to be treated like less of a deal by Arthur than the other, but when the other knights testify, like, okay, the fact is she really is, we don't know how to put this, but let's just say we find it entirely plausible, his story, that she approached him. Okay, we think we probably got to side with Lanval on this one. Arthur does not react. And he's like, oh, but he still said that her lady was more beautiful than the queen. We must answer that charge. And it's like, didn't we just like legally establish that Guinevere is cheating on you? Shouldn't we? Isn't that kind of a bigger deal at this point? Apparently not to Arthur. So that's, and you know, in some ways, I think this is kind of an awkwardness. The accusation of adultery question is treated much more slightly in the original text. When Marie de France tells this story, Guinevere mentions that, but the focus is very little on that, and there's certainly no legal discussion of it at the trial. By the time we get to the trial, it's just completely forgotten, and we're only talking about the comparative beauty. Our English poet, Thomas Chester, tells us his name is there at the end, Chester says that he makes a bigger deal of it, right? And he brings it into the trial, which makes it kind of awkward. Like, okay, but we're just going to drop that. I guess, what, will there be an investigation later on? Does Arthur not care? I don't know. But it certainly is not any longer the issue. Now the issue is just that boast. Yeah, yeah, go ahead, Jordan.
The footnotes actually do suggest there is a legal basis for the insult thing. It's clearly not, you know, as big a deal as the whole treason thing, from what they say, but apparently it's slander against the king if you insult the queen in any way. Which, I mean, that's you know, not huge, but...
Yeah, no, it's definitely squishier than the adultery thing. Way squishier.
He's trying to avoid his cheating on him. I imagine he'd want to punish anyone he has a chance to punish.
Right, though one possibly could expect that his ire would be directed less towards Lanval than towards his queen at that point. But especially since, again, he's been almost exonerated from that chief accusation. Yeah, I agree. I mean, sure, you know, there can be legal consequences to insulting the king, which is pretty much what it amounts to. I mean, we've been talking about the boast and, you know, the beauty comparison. But, of course, what he has said is not just, my lady is more beautiful than the queen. He's couched that comparison as insultingly as he can, right? The loathliest servant of my lady is more beautiful than the queen, is what he has said. And that's the, you know, like that Lothlochist word gets repeated a lot in the trial, right? It is the insult contained in that really keeps coming up. What's at stake for Arthur here? Why does he care so much? What's this? How do we understand this, Kelly?
It seems that Arthur has given up so much to be with Guinevere because she's really, really beautiful. And if we can't establish that she's in fact faithful to him, then all he has is that he has the most beautiful lady in, you know, all the kingdom. And if Lanval is challenging that, then he's undermining that hierarchy, I guess.
Yeah. There is a hierarchy thing, especially the terms in which the insult is placed make it explicitly, sort of evoke hierarchy explicitly, like the lowest member of her hierarchy is higher than the highest member of your hierarchy. as far as the ladies are concerned, rated by beauty, as ladies almost always are rated by beauty. But yeah, I mean, we saw at the beginning with his rejection of Guinevere, that is not her, his rejection of her advances because she isn't making any yet, but of his sort of distancing himself from her and his kind of separation from the Arthurian court in consequence, we see him already sort of choosing between those two worlds, right? Okay, if this world, the Arthurian world, now means that, if this is now, this new identity is being grafted into the Arthurian world, that it, through his marriage of Guinevere, I'm not going to have any part of that anymore, and that's where he ends up then being joined to that other world, right? So now when he comes back, he's not left the fairy world. He's not left Tremor behind and come back to Arthur in the way that he left Arthur in order to find her. So in him, we have both of these worlds still together. And the vehemency with which he rejects that does seem to be a big part of the deal. That is, Arthur does seem to see, everyone seems to see, the terms in place here. This is one world against another. And of course, the other world, which they don't even see, or even really know anything about, or in fact understand at all even that he's talking about another world exactly, right? That is, all he says is, my girlfriend is really beautiful, so beautiful that even her servants are more beautiful than the queen. And Gawain clearly doesn't understand what's going on, right? Even though he's very sort of good-naturedly on Lanval's side, right? When he sees the servants coming, he's immediately, that must be her, right? I see this really, really beautiful woman. Actually, the whole pack of really beautiful women coming. Surely, your lady is among them. No. No, you don't understand. And that's the moment when they start arriving. That's the moment when to everybody it becomes clear. What we have here is not just a comparison among these women seen equally. Instead, we have very clearly the arrival of a foreign court, right? The maiden's coming in advance to prepare her way and to deck the chambers and to get everything ready for the arrival of a foreign dignitary. And Arthur to receive her as one would receive a foreign dignitary. And it's then that everyone clearly sees what is at stake here are these two different poles. This is not just something else coming into Arthur's world. Robbie?
I just have a question. I don't know if it's said in the text or not, but how did he know that she would be coming? Because Lanfall just says she's riding here, and that's it. So how did he know that was it?
He doesn't. He seems... what's his reaction when he's arrested? What's his reaction? I think there are several interesting things that we can see about how he responds to the arrest and to the specific charges that are placed against him, the experience of being on trial. When is he arrested? What is the moment when he is arrested? What has just happened when he is arrested?
I think it's he's discovered that all the gifts she's given him have either vanished or decreased in quality to something less than jewels and gold. And, of course, Gifra has taken the horse and threw it away.
Right. Gifra is gone. Yeah, he goes back to his room after the party. They've been out dancing and stuff. He goes back to his room with the plan and hope to summon his lady, as he usually does. But she doesn't come. And Gifra is gone, and the horse is gone. Yeah, and all. So he's just realized that's it, right? I was going to say being punished, but it's not exactly punishment. I mean, he has broken their agreement. And he recognizes this is the consequence. And in that moment, he's arrested and hauled before the king when he recognizes that he's already been separated from his lady. And of course, now we have the ironic moment which builds the dramatic tension, right? Now that he has cut himself off from his lady is now the time when, in order to save his life, he has to produce his lady, which of course he couldn't have done anyway. It would have been the worst possible breaking of his previous oath to, like, trot her out like a sideshow, right? And now, Lanfall's sexy girlfriend, right? That would have been the worst kind of boast that he could have made. But of course now, she won't even come to him in private anymore. So he's totally cut off from her, but forced to produce her. So yeah, he can't do this, and he seems to have no expectation that he's going to do this. Therefore, what does he do? Does he confess to the charges? What does he do? Does he back down? How does he respond to this? Because again, I think that we can see some interesting things here, both with his relationship to the Arthurian court and his relationship to Triamore's court. Jordan?
He kind of seems to, I don't know what good word, a good single word is, so I'll use those seven alone. He becomes less animated and less involved in things, as if once Triamore is removed, there's no real purpose. Like, he might as well be killed because his life is gone. And also in response to the earlier comment about going right against his reaction, it's when she actually shows up and he says, "Hail, he said, come into my land on Sweater. Shame meet of me, Bella's better, yet that Lady Walder." And that's actually when she shows up at the gate. Previously to that, he's just like, "No, they are not her. You don't, you guys, you're trying to cheer me up and just sucking and you guys suck."
Yeah, it's not working. It's not working. Yes, yes, good. It's only when he sees her that he seems to show hope. Yeah, he doesn't show much hope, and he does seem to be, you know, fairly resigned to, you know, being executed. Or now, once the whole thing about actually turns out, Your Majesty, your wife is, Lanfall's probably innocent of this one. That's when he changes the sentence, right? At first, we were talking about execution. At that point, he's like, okay. Exile, though. Exile. Let's exile him for his boast and his insult to the queen. But exile is kind of an ironic penalty under the circumstances, right? Mister, like, yeah, I've done the exile thing, right? I initiated the exile thing before. And one has to think that for several reasons, he wouldn't particularly care to stick around, actually. Right? I mean, how much worse are things now than when he separated himself from the court in the first place? Right? He seemed to sort of distance himself from Guinevere and from Guinevere's Arthurian court previously on far less, with far less reason than he has now to do so. So, the whole exile thing is not exactly, you know, the most horrible threat hanging over his head right now. But notice that he does not deny it. That is, he maintains what is strictly the truth. He's being accused of two things. You tried to seduce Guinevere, and you insulted her. And he remains strictly honest in his response. "No, I am innocent of attempting to seduce Guinevere. I wouldn't have her on a plate. But I am guilty of insulting her. In fact, I will fulsomely repeat the insult in front of you all right now, and I stand by it. It is true. Can I produce her? Can I prove it? No. But it's true. And I'd say it again. I shouldn't have said it the first time, but having said it once, I'll say it again." And that's interesting. What does that show us? What does that show us about him? We talked about what his boast shows us about him. What does that show us about him? Liz?
I feel like at that point there was more like loyalty to his lady than anything else, because he wasn't even boasting.
Yeah. Having once made the boast, he shouldn't have made the boast, but having once made the boast, he's not going to further insult her by backing down. And not only would it be further insulting her, for him to change his story now would be continuing the mistake he made before, right? Will, what were you thinking?
I was thinking that whatever else Lanfall might be, you know, boastful, proud, whatever, he is not.
Yeah. Yeah, he does not seem to be. I mean, when we saw this from the beginning, right? You know, he's not going to. He doesn't actually seek his own aggrandizement generally, right? He just slipped up that one time when, as Marta said, Guinevere pushes his buttons, right? It's not even just the situation that makes it happen. It's her. But yeah, he. If he were to back down now, if he were to say, no, the thing about my lady, I shouldn't have said that. I was, not true. I'm sorry. Now, he would be denying her for the sake of his own advancement. Right? So we see him now sticking it out because he's no longer seeking himself. He doesn't care. He knows that it condemns him. He knows that there is no defense because he can't produce her. And so, therefore, he is accepting his condemnation by reiterating his boast and also sticking by her. So that's nice. Now, he passes the test on his first opportunity to wimp out and deny his loyalty to her and to aggrandize himself at her expense. He did that the one time. He has another chance to do it, and he doesn't the second time at the trial. He has two more chances to save himself dishonestly and disloyally to her. Do you remember that? When are those? Dale?
Is it one of them? The fact that he had the opportunity to claim that one of Tree Ward's ladies was Tree Ward.
Yeah. Gawain gives him that chance twice, right? Because this is not just, hey, I could take that as a way out. He is offered a way out on a platter, right? I mean, Gawain says to him, wow, look at that lady coming. If one of those is your lady, you are totally getting off on this trial, right? I mean, you are completely, like, you would be found innocent if you said that one of those ladies, because, wow, they are so much more beautiful than the queen. No question. Trial over. And he says, no, I've never seen them before. I have no idea who they are. So he could have done that. But again, his only motivation to do that would be to preserve himself. It's a little hard on him calling, get yourself off at a major trial, putting that in the category of self-aggrandizement, right? I mean, that's a little unfair. There's a little more at stake here than just boosting your image with other people. But he doesn't do that. One thing I want to clarify, I was really interested in the discussion board, the exchange that several of you were having about loyalties and his political loyalties between the Arthurian court and the court of Triamor. I thought that thread was sort of particularly interesting and relevant to the stuff that we were talking about today, so I wanted to comment on that. I think that you're right to see, the several of you who are talking about it, you're right to see a kind of a political implication here when he leaves Arthur's court and goes to her, and the fact that he's carrying her banner as well as riding her horse and being accompanied by her mega squire. It's also, that's true. But I don't think that we should be seeing this as disloyalty politically to Arthur. I don't think he's done anything bad, anything wrong in that way. The way that feudalism is a two-way street. That is, you swear an oath of fealty to your lord, but your lord also swears an oath to you. And you hold lands, so your lord gives you lands, he gives you a fief, and you hold those lands under his authority. If you don't have, if he takes those away from you, you don't have anything to be loyal for anymore. That is, if he breaks it, you don't have to keep it anymore. And you can also, for this reason, have feudal oaths to more than one person at the same time. You could be given a fief by two different rulers. And then, of course, it's possible, theoretically, that those two oaths could put you at cross purposes at various points, especially if your lords are not agreeing with each other. But if you hold lands from one king and hold another lands from another king, you would you could swear oaths to both of them. This was exactly the awkward situation that a lot of the Norman lords of England were put in at the very beginning of the 13th century. After the Norman conquest, of course, William the Conqueror and his barons, obviously, he was the Duke of Normandy, and they were major landholders in Normandy before they conquered England. So the major Norman families in England in the first century of Norman rule had major lands in Normandy and lands in England, and this was no problem because the same person was King of England and Duke of Normandy, that is, William and his successors. But at the beginning of the 13th century, the King of France decided that he'd had enough of that and demanded that the King of England, as Duke of Normandy, swear fealty to him as King of France, and he refused, and the King of France then annexed Normandy and sacked it. And said, okay, Normandy is mine now. Nobody can hold lands here and still say that they hold these lands under the King of England. These are my lands now. So anyone who has these lands, who wants to keep these lands, has to swear fealty to me instead of to him, because they didn't have any fealty to the King of France. So basically they had to choose. Do they want to keep their English holdings? Do they want to go back to Normandy? And a lot of people split up. That is, there were some families where there were like two sons, one of which went and took the Norman lands and the other which stayed in England. But basically the decision point had come, which one of these they were going to do. And again, that was depending on which lands they kept, because now the Norman lands belong to him and the English lands belong to him. In any case, what we see of Lanfal, he doesn't owe anybody anything when he's a poor beggar living in an orchard and riding out and falling in the mud. He doesn't seem to have any wins. There's another moment in a couple other Arthurian stories. At the end, near the end of the Arthurian story, this is in the French Vulgate, and it's... Emily will correct me if I'm wrong. I think Mallory says this too. Gawain gets really mad at Arthur when Arthur is going to carry out the execution of the queen. When he finally, evidence is brought to him that Lancelot and Guinevere are sleeping together, and he says, okay, well, I'm going to have to burn Guinevere at the stake because she's guilty of treason. That's what you do to women who are guilty of treason, so I'm going to do this. And Gawain says, this is a horrible thing to do. I totally disagree with this. And what he does, Gawain divests himself of his lance. He says, I'm severing ties with you, Arthur. But of course, he can't just walk away and be like, I'm not going to obey you anymore if he's still his vassal, if he still holds lands under Arthur. So he says, Arthur, I'm giving you back every acre of land you have ever given me. I hold nothing under you. And therefore, I am walking out of your court and never coming back. Now, this only lasts about, like, 6 hours, actually, before Gawain is back, because the situation changes right after this. Does the divestiture happen in Mallory? I can't remember.
Gawain's like, no, this is false crap.
Yeah, he storms out, I remember, but in the French Vulgate, in Mallory's sources, that he ceremonially divests himself of his fiefs. Again, briefly, like the next week he takes them back again. But if you do that, you're no longer bound. Lanfal, when he leaves the court, does seem to disconnect him from Arthur. He certainly does not seem to have any benefits from Arthur's court, hence his poverty. So Lanfal is kind of a free agent when he's in the woods and picked up by the fairy queen. So I don't think that there's a question of his, like, now he's breaking a vow to Arthur. You only do that if you try to sort of have your cake and eat it too, if you were speaking. That is, keep the lands, but break the vow of loyalty to the Lord. But I think it was really interesting, and I think it's really important, because we do see that kind, especially here at the end, when Lady Triamore shows up at the court, we do see a kind of political situation. As I said, we have like the foreign potentate who is coming into town and who is having this meeting with Arthur. And we do have a confrontation of these two different powers, these two different courts. And Lanfal chooses. No questions. Congratulations, Lanfal. You are innocent. You are not going to be exiled. What are you going to do now?
I'm going to Fairyland.
I'm going to exile myself. Right? That's okay. It's okay. I'm just going to carry out the sentence that you would have carried out if I was guilty. Oh, none of this matters. What matters is that I choose her over you if the choice has to be made. And apparently it does, because of Arthur's adherence to the queen. What'd you make of Guinevere's blinding?
That was so cool. This is one of the coolest things in this entire poem. Because Marie de France's poem gets picked up and retold in a couple other places, there are other places where you can find Guinevere acting as horribly as this. This poem is not unique for how despicable Guinevere is, though it is in this like thread of uniquely horrible Guinevere tradition. But in no other version does Guinevere get stricken blind. And the manner of it. She just blows in her face. And her eyes wither. It's powerful stuff right there. What do you make of it? Why has our man Thomas Chester added that? Any thoughts? Beth?
I think it's symbolic of how blind she already is.
It's hard not to go there. I agree. Yeah, she's... What's she blind to? In what sense is she blind?
her own value. She thinks she's so much more important than she is. So much more desirable.
Yeah, good. I agree. I think that's a really neat way of thinking about it. The kind of self-absorption... Right, that she really seems to believe that she is that great, right? She seems to be she's deceived. Remember what we were talking about way back on the first day of class. You know, like Wednesday feels like a year ago. But anyway, about the relationship between appearances and realities in this poem, we can see that as a sort of a theme from the beginning. And we, you know, I was talking at the time about the gap in the queen between her appearances and her reality. She's very beautiful and she's great and she's sort of the pinnacle of the Arthurian court once they're married, but. You know, she's her inward parts do not reflect. You know, her character does not reflect the outside. She, however, in a sense, I agree with Beth here. Sort of seems to buy or doesn't seem to see that, right? She seems to believe that she really is the greatest, and that this doesn't matter. You remember she does call it upon herself, right? It's not a random thing that Triamor does when she gets there. Guinevere makes something that is almost like a rash vow or a rash boast when she's leveling the accusations against Launfal. This is line 805. During the beginning parts of the trial. All in fair they mad profferinga, that Launfal should his laymon bringa, his head hagan to lie. Then said the quina without lazing, if he bringeth a fairer thing, put out mean iron gray. Oops. Right. And she does. Now, Guinevere presumably didn't mean that literally. But I think we can see, she boasts of herself here. And she is compelled to abide by the terms of her boast. Duncan?
Well, I was also thinking, this could be more than a punishment. This could be a correction. I mean, she's blinding her to material things. Mm-hmm. And this might make her better as a person in the long run. Might make Guinevere realize that it's not all about being the most beautiful and being the best, and might make her realize that it's not true.
Yeah, and also, hey, stop chasing after other knights, right? Yeah, maybe it will help that, too. Maybe it will restrict her extracurricular activities. there does seem to be something corrective about it. Not simply punitive, not simply vengeful. As she
is she keeps using the language of vengeance. She wants to be a reka on him. Right? I just want to get back at him. I want to see him suffer for what he did. And I agree, I don't think that we necessarily see Triamore responding in kind to her. Especially since, technically, she brought it on herself. Though again, presumably she didn't mean it literally. Yeah, Beskin? That's actually kind of lovely, right? Yeah. Here, I will now put you in the world where you are the most beautiful. You're now like that. You're beautiful. You're more beautiful than anything you can see, right? Yeah. No, I like that. I like that. Here's the perfect fulfillment of your sad little world, Guinevere. Or perhaps revelation of what her world is really already like, right? And this, again, coming back to Beth's first comment about her sort of being already, in a sense, blinded. I like it. I think that's great. I think that works really well. We should, before we go, talk about Lanval's final fate. That is, he chooses. When given the choice, he chooses, right? Gifra comes up with the horse, and he's like, yes, and he gets on the horse and follows her, right? So he chooses, no question. He's not staying. He's riding off to Faerie with her. Where do they go? This is a trick question. The Isle of Oleroon, of course. This is a little perplexing. Marie de France says Avalon, which is the traditional place where fairies are located, and we'll see that coming up in other places. But the Isle of Oleroon is actually an island off the coast of Brittany. Yet it's clear. So one possible thing would be here that like Chester didn't like the idea of like, oh, they're going off to some like, you know, island that like doesn't exist in the real world. So he gives them a real geographic, like bona fide geographical location to go to. You know, like they have a. It's not that, you know, Lanfal and Triamore don't have a, you know, an actual postal address anymore. Like you can find them on the Isle of Oleroon. But I don't think so, because we're told that he goes to Faerie. I mean, Chester doesn't make any bones about the fact that he is in Faerie with her. So he doesn't seem to be squeamish about that. Does this sort of suggest sort of mystical associations that they had with that particular isle? I'm not really sure. It seems quite possible. But anyway, it's sort of a curiosity in some sense. One thing that I love about the end of this poem, and it's in Marie de France too, and Chester keeps it, is that sort of the little sort of summary of the end that is like, now like looking back, here's what this story was about. At the beginning of the last stanza, thus Lanfal with Uten Fable, that noble knicht of the Rune Table, was tak into Faerie. This is the story of how the noble knight, Lanfal, was taken into Faerie. I think we've seen, like we saw Herodes taken into Faerie, right? And I also really like the discussion on the discussion board about the difference between Herodes's being taken into Faerie and Lanfal's being taken. And I think it's especially interesting here, right? He went of his own volition. In fact, in this version, he rides on his own horse. In Marie de France, it's really charming. He's being held in the trial. And they let him go. They're like, okay, you're free to go. So he goes running out on foot. She gets back on her horse and goes riding out. And he, like, ambushes her by the door. So he, like, jumps up on a mounting block right next to the door. And as she rides by, he jumps onto the back of her horse and is like, see ya, and off he goes. So there you can see in Marie even more strongly foregrounds this sort of tension between going and being taken to Faerie, right? He doesn't actually... Now, of course, even here, though, he's still riding a Faerie horse, right? So you could still say that there's still some parallel there. But goodness, nobody ever went more willingly to Faerie than Lanfal does here at the end of this, or more of his own volition. And yet this is still characterized in the end as being taken to Faerie. And I think that that's... in itself kind of interesting. But once a year, you can still joust with him if you want. This is not in Marie.
He rides off into the distance, probably to Avalon, the ant. But it's not the ant here. Once a year, to keep his armor from rust, right? He's got to keep his hand in as a jouster. You can hear him, and the hearing still has this sort of mysterious fairy quality. You can hear the sound of his horse, right? And maybe you can meet him and challenge him to joust. Right? It's not just, but once a year he still showed up at the Arthurian court to go to, like, the major tournament. It's not quite like that. You can go out and still find him once a year, if you want to joust with him. But he's now part of fairy, and therefore the encounter with him is kind of like encounters with fairy. In our last 60 seconds, general thoughts, now that we've read two of these medieval fairy stories, general things that you notice, trends. I said before at the beginning that I didn't want to, you know, start off by lecturing about the, you know, what we believe to be true about fairies and all that sort of thing in the Middle Ages. I wanted us to sort of see empirically. What do you notice so far? Brittany?
The appearance of fairies is heavily detailed in both.
Good. Yeah, what they look like is a big deal, and what they look like is pretty similar. Wealthy, beautiful. Two very clear trends. Radiant. Yes. And I agree, we've never yet met a fairy and not had a long physical description. Especially compared to the physical description we get of other things, which is very little, usually. Yeah? Good. Good, yes, we have this place, which is usually, in both cases, communal. It's like you don't just meet a stray single fairy in the middle of the woods. In fact, have we ever seen a single fairy by him or herself? I don't think so. They're always in gangs, sometimes cities, right? Always large parties. I mean, seriously, have we seen fewer than 60 fairies in one place at any time? So, I mean, I think that that's interesting, especially when juxtaposed with the forest, right? You have to totally separate yourself, go out in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the forest, and that's where you'll meet huge cities or enormous throngs of fairies, apparently. So I agree. I think both of those are really interesting things. Will?
Even though there are a lot of them, we know almost something about.
Okay, good. Yet we still don't know why the fairy king wanted Herodotus exactly. We don't know. I mean, we can sort of assume, but almost all those assumptions are based upon assuming that his motivations would be like a human being's motivations, which don't necessarily seem to be fair. And yet, why? Why does Triamor do what she did? We have even less reason. I mean, she says that she loves him more, and I guess, like, he's worthy in a sense, but certainly at the end, what we see at the end of this poem is not his worthiness being rewarded. He is being rewarded despite his unworthiness. He has shown himself unworthy. He has screwed up. He does not deserve to keep her. And he certainly doesn't deserve for her to do what she does. I agree. It's a little bit mysterious. Why did she take him in the first place? Why does she come back after he's broken his vow? And we don't know. Yeah, good. Kat?
When people go into fairy, they come back definitely changed. Herodotus didn't say anything for the rest of the film, and Lanfall goes and actually sort of becomes a fairy.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. That is an interesting way to think about Herodotus, too. Because we, you know, and to think about her silence for the rest of the poem, are we to assume that she's back to normal and the reason she doesn't talk is that, you know, it's kind of like unremarkable, like we're just resuming where she left off, or that she is so changed that we don't hear from her? Man, I think that that's an interesting question. Yes, it does certainly seem to have an impact. Yeah, Tara?
Could it almost be in this Jurassic Live that we've been taking away Harry? And if he was going to be dead to death or exiled, then it's almost kind of a door for maybe dead to death in a way.
Yeah, I mean, he's...
And he chooses that. He does some stuff to take that he chooses for himself by defending her.
Yeah.
Against the queens, where he could have chosen, okay, I choose the court, but he, like, throws in his camp with her, so...
Yeah. I agree. There is something throughout the trial, there's something that feels like tautology about the whole thing, right? As we can see from the ending, like the outcome of the trial is literally meaningless. In that way, if that's the sort of final climax of the poem, it's deeply anticlimactic. Hooray! You don't have to be exiled. Yeah. When she comes back for him, if she doesn't come back, he's exiled. If she does come back, he's exiled. I mean, then he's going to exile, and he's choosing exile both. It's not even like, well, he'll be forced versus choosing. No, he's choosing it both ways. It's like, is it a happy exile or a sad exile? But that's the chief difference. Yeah. All right, I must let you go. Dame Ragnall for Wednesday.
Okay, for next time, read the first half of The Wedding of Sir Gawain and Dame Ragnall, where we'll meet a guy with a funny name and a strikingly unattractive lady. Fun for the whole family. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.